cost of war
as troops are drawn down in Afghanistan.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, May 2nd.
Coming up, students on a hunger strike over tuition at state colleges.
And how good are those real estate websites that tell you how much the houses are worth?
Plus, Newtons without figs.
Just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
America's role in the war in Afghanistan is winding down. That's the word from President Obama, who said last night during his speech in Afghanistan that the goal is for Afghan forces to lead combat operations by next year.
Last year, we removed 10,000 U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Another 23,000 will leave by the end of the summer. After that, reductions will continue at a steady pace with more and more of our troops coming home.
As for cost savings from the planned drawdown, well, we asked Mark Jacobson, a former NATO representative in Afghanistan who's now a fellow at the German Marshall Fund. He says, sure, the U.S. will save money on combat operations.
But it's also going to cost a significant amount of money to bring our troops out and bring their equipment out. So I don't expect that we're going to see some sort of savings spike that could be reinvested within the Department of Defense, much less the rest of the federal government.
As of last year, by the way, according to the Congressional Research Service, the total cost of 10 years of war in Afghanistan has been $443 billion.
European finance ministers met today about how much money banks should have around in case of emergency. Banks argue the more that's set aside, the less they have to lend and invest. The U.S. has agreed to new rules about this, but banks continue to push back. Marketplace's Stephen Beer joins us from London with more on this. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, David.
Well, making banks keep extra cash in their accounts as a kind of safety net because, right, if they don't, sometimes the government is asked to come in with a bailout.
Absolutely, yes. But, you know, this is really the collision between two opposing ideas. On the one hand, as you say, you've got those who say it's vital that you tighten up the rules to make sure banks have got enough money in reserve to prevent another Lehman-style collapse. But on the other hand, you have those who say if you increase bank reserves, banks will lend less money to businesses and households. That will deprive the global economy of around $1 trillion worth of credit a year, and that could be disastrous when parts of the global economy, especially Europe, are so fragile.
How does this play out in Europe, where we know that banks and governments are already having, let's call them, financial issues?
Indeed. Well, today's meeting is about whether the European Union should implement the new global rules by the beginning of next year. Now, the Germans and the UK in particular argue that bank safety is paramount and the new tougher rules should be introduced before the end of this year. But finance ministers from weaker economies like those of Italy and Spain are not so keen, as Ralph Silver of the SRN consulting firm points out.
The ministers are saying instead of doing it this year, because they don't want to reduce that amount of money that's out in the marketplace, they're suggesting maybe moving it a year forward or maybe even farther until the economy has had a chance to recover.
And some of these economies certainly need to recover, like Spain, which is back in recession.
So which way are these meetings going to go today, Stephen?
Well, they don't absolutely have to decide today. So you know what? They probably won't. They'll probably kick the can down the road.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London.
Well, if you want to know how the housing market is doing, you can check this morning's numbers from the Mortgage Bankers Association. They say mortgage applications were up about 3% last week. Another way to gauge the health of the housing market, of course, is to check one of those websites like Zillow or Trulia to see how much your own house is worth. But as Marketplace's Bob Moon reports, there are questions about the reliability of those sites.
Spend any time combing through the big home listing websites, and some of the properties might ring a bell. In more ways than one. Maybe the same home is pictured multiple times with different prices or conflicting descriptions. Or perhaps the listing is so old the home has long since been sold. Jim Abbott runs a San Diego real estate firm. He says he recently heard from clients complaining their house was still online 10 months after closing escrow.
You know, we have people coming to the front door frequently, peeking in our windows.
All the inaccurate listings, he says, are skewing pricing perceptions among both sellers and buyers, and that, he claims, might even be slowing the housing recovery.
Telling the public there are 3 to 4 times as many properties on the market than there actually are, you're giving them the false sense of this huge inventory.
Abbott is so convinced his sales are being hurt, he recently pulled his listings from 3 leading websites, Zillow, Trulia, and Realtor.com. But Zillow CEO Spencer Raskoff told us that decision will only hurt Abbott's own clients.
A seller has got to be completely nuts to list their home with a listing agent that wasn't going to put their home on the biggest websites in their city.
Raskoff insists Zillow is extremely focused on listings quality. Zillow says it gathers listings through hundreds of sources, from national listing services to broker websites. Then it uses a kind of secret sauce computer algorithm to weed through the data.
Obviously, it serves our business interest to satisfy our consumers, and our consumers demand accurate listings. That's why we're focused on it.
Hobie Hanna is a real estate executive in Ohio. He agrees with Abbott that the websites need to be more accurate. But rather than pull his listings, Hanna is trying a different tactic. He recently made a deal to advertise on Zillow, and in return, he controls the information posted for his properties. Hanna says customers want their listings everywhere.
If you're trying to sell your house in today's market, your attitude is expose it to as many places. I want to get my house sold. I don't want it to be the secret house that nobody knows is for sale.
Hanna says whether real estate agents like it or not, they're no longer the only place to go to find a home. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The jobs picture in the U.S. clouded over today with news that businesses did not hire nearly as many people as expected in April. The data is for private sector businesses, as tabulated by the payroll company ADP. Companies added 119,000 jobs last month, but that's a drop of 40% from a month earlier. And today some college students in California begin a hunger strike. They're protesting higher tuition at California State universities. Students reportedly plan to consume only fluids until the Board of Trustees meets their demands, including a 5-year freeze on the cost of tuition. As Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, it's not just California where tensions are rising over costs at state schools.
California State universities plan to hike tuition rates by 9% this fall. 4-year colleges in other states, from Nebraska to Virginia to Mississippi, will also charge more. Jose Cruz tracks the issue for Education Trust, an advocacy group. He says students at top-tier universities tend to come from wealthier families, while students at less selective schools, like Cal State universities, are more likely to come from low-income families that earn less than $30,000 a year.
The family has to set aside the equivalent of 72% of their annual household income in order to be able to pay for one single year.
Students are paying more because states are paying less, and it's not just because of the recession. John Quinterno studied changes in college funding for the public policy firm Demos.
Collectively, states are spending about 26% less per full-time equivalent student now than they did 20 years ago.
He says that even with the economic downturn, the country is richer than it was 20 years ago. Back when we were poorer, Quinterno says, we spent more on higher education. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Protesters were out in force in several cities yesterday demanding an end to income inequality. Many of the rallies were allied with the Occupy movement, and therefore there weren't a lot of politicians involved. Even those political leaders who agree with Occupy demonstrators have kept an arm's length so far. Chuck Collins would like to close that political gap. He's the author of a new book called 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. Chuck Collins, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how long do you think it's going to take, and what are you going to look for to know that what you want to happen in terms of reducing income inequality is working?
Well, actually, the realignment may happen faster than we think because, you know, here we are in an election year where the politics of the 99 to 1, I think, will be at the center of our national debate. That doesn't mean anything will actually change in terms of laws and legislation in the short term. I think over the next 3-4 years, however, people are waking up and saying, do these elected officials actually represent me?
Is it your expectation then that if President Obama gets reelected, that all of a sudden he's going to embrace the tenets of this movement and start really dealing with inequality in a big way?
Well, President Obama has – I don't think he's leading on this issue. I think he's reflecting and mirroring shifting public opinion. The public is requiring him. He's trying to get out in front of the parade.
Well, do you think that he'll be responding legislatively in the next term of his administration if he gets one?
I think it depends on whether these social movements succeed in connecting broadly and also whether they can defeat candidates who have been completely aligned with the 1%. And that will ultimately trigger a realignment.
Finally, I want to ask you, you know a little something about the 1%. You were at one time an heir to the Oscar Mayer fortune. You gave your money away at age 26. Why did you do that, and how did that inform your point of view on this?
Well, yeah, it's important. I grew up in the 1%. In fact, I went to high school with Mitt Romney. Hmm. We grew up in the same neighborhood and sledded on the same sledding hill. So that gives me one perspective, which is that within the 1%, there's a huge segment of people who are allies, who actually are working for an economy that works for everybody. But it's also helped me understand that within the 1%, there's a group of people who use their wealth and power to rig the rules to get more wealth and power.
Was Romney a good sledder?
He was a good older kid in the neighborhood. He was a polite, thoughtful kid. And, you know, he was the son of the governor, so he had to have good manners.
Chuck Collins is the author of 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. Chuck Collins, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
The social media company Facebook is expected to sell its stock publicly sometime this month and would likely be valued by the stock market at something like $100 billion. The Wall Street Journal reports today that next week the company will start trying to win over investors privately and could start officially selling stock, perhaps on May 18th. Joining us now is Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore. Hello, Heidi.
Hi, David.
So the strong suggestion is that Facebook will go public later this month. What happens until then?
Well, starting today or starting this week, the company's going to go on what Wall Street calls a roadshow, which sounds exactly like it is. It's like a concert tour. Like, this is Spinal Tap for finance. So all the executives are going to meet with investors all across the country and tell them how great Facebook is and why they should buy the shares. So these roadshows can be really fun affairs. When Kraft went public earlier this decade, they gave out baskets of Oreos and macaroni and cheese. But Facebook isn't going that route. No, they're going cut rate. So Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO, is not even going to be there. And I don't think investors are going to like that because they're putting millions in the company. They want to see the guy who's running the show.
Probably trying to save just a little bit of money there because, you know, they don't have a lot of cash rattling around. So perhaps then the Facebook offering might, I don't know, disappoint. Are there concerns?
Yeah, not so much. It's an incredibly popular deal. There are shares everywhere. Everyone's clamoring for them. Yes, the company has slow ad revenue. Yes, they paid $1 billion for Instagram. But the power dynamic in this deal has changed a lot. Everyone already knows what Facebook is about. I talked to Jason Raznick. He's the editor of Benzinga.com. It's a stock investment site. Here's how he described it.
This is definitely a different kind of roadshow. It's kind of like you have to go through the motions, but you're almost not there pitching it because everyone already knows the pitch.
Right. Everyone knows what Facebook's about. So the company is apparently going to go public May 18th. Stay tuned. It should be big.
Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore. Thank you.
Well, executives from the online TV site Hulu are in New York today, along with their counterparts from Yahoo, YouTube, and AOL, selling their content to advertisers. The event is called the Digital Upfronts, an alternative to the traditional TV upfronts. But as Sally Herships reports, a site like Hulu is no longer the alternative to cable it once was.
Did you cancel your cable subscription because you can watch Hulu for free? Too bad. You may have to start paying for cable TV again.
Fox is already doing this.
Todd Spangler is technology editor for Multichannel News.
The episode of House that aired on Monday, you can't get it free on Hulu until the 8th of May.
But subscribers to Dish Satellite TV don't have to wait, and they can watch shows on Hulu for free. Spangler says TV companies need to keep viewers paying. Otherwise, cable companies might tell them,
hey, you're throwing all your stuff out there for free. Why should I pay you anything?
Sam Craig is a media expert at NYU's Stern School of Business. He says content providers have two options, increasing prices or selling more ads.
If you sell more ad time, you increase the clutter. It becomes less desirable as a watching experience for consumers. And so you're ultimately between a rock and a hard place.
Which is why content on Hulu may not always be free. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
It's a fact of life that some people are more motivated to work hard than others, whether in school or maybe down at the office. Well, a new study has discovered a possible clue as to what sets worker bees apart from the frequent snack break takers. You know who they are. Turns out the ones who like to work hard are also the ones who have higher levels of dopamine in some parts of their brain.
Here to talk with us about the findings is Michael Treadway, lead author of the study, who is also a clinical fellow at McLean Hospital at Harvard Medical School. He's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how did you figure out that dopamine plays a key role in motivating people?
Well, the first hint came from a body of research actually performed in rats, where researchers would give rats a choice between pressing a lever for a larger reward or just taking a freely available reward. And they found that while healthy rats always preferred to work, the rats who had some kind of block to their dopamine system, those rats shifted their preference so that now they preferred to not work and take the easier reward, even though they preferred it less. And we thought that that was an interesting model of motivation, and we tried to replicate that in humans. That was our first hint that dopamine might be something we want to look at as a neurochemical underlying this kind of trait difference in motivation.
Now, I know, of course, you're a man of science, but it does strike me that what you found is a link between lack of dopamine and tendency toward being a slacker.
Yes. What we found was that individuals who were less interested or less motivated to work during a behavioral task did have a less responsive dopamine system, at least in the areas that are primarily involved in reward motivation and anticipation. One of the things that was unexpected about the study is we found that those individuals who preferred to work less actually had a little more dopamine associated in a different brain region, a region called the anterior insula, which has been found previously to be associated with anticipating negative outcomes, negative stimuli, or financial losses. So one way to think about this is we found that dopamine in some regions of the brain was associated with folks focusing a little bit more on what they could gain and therefore being more motivated to pursue it, and dopamine in a different region was associated with more of a focus on what the costs might be. And so they were a little less motivated to expend the extra effort.
Well, so for all of these slackers that are listening to this, what are they supposed to do to get a little more dopamine?
One of the things that is most amazing about the dopamine system is how plastic it is and how much dopamine systems can be changed based on experience to reinforcers. So if you're not necessarily experiencing an immediate sense of motivation, maybe just try doing something anyway, even if you're not feeling motivated, and see if the motivation comes. Sort of the idea of action may precede motivation for some folks.
What are you hoping results from your research?
Well, I'm hoping that this starts to help uncover some of the complexity of the role of the dopaminergic system in determining motivation, where it's not just more dopamine is better, but it really depends on specific brain regions, which I think has implications for the administration of dopaminergic drugs in the future, as well as exploring dopamine systems as a basis for deficits or low motivation in clinical populations. A lot of conditions like depression are associated with a lower sense of motivation, not anticipating enjoying things or feeling motivated to do them. And this research starts to point to the idea that that may have a dopaminergic component.
Dr. Michael Treadway, author of the study and also a clinical fellow at McLean Hospital at Harvard Medical School, thanks a lot for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Today, the painting known far and wide as The Scream goes on auction at Sotheby's in New York. There are several versions of Edvard Munch's piece, but this is the only one to hit the open market, and it's expected to fetch something like $80 million, as Christopher Worth reports.
When Munch painted The Scream in 1895, it shocked the art world. The central figure in the painting covers its ears and appears to scream under a blood-red sky. David Norman of Sotheby's says the picture presaged the turmoil of the 20th century.
It is a universal image of anxiety, suffering, the response to the modern age.
Since then, the Scream has become an icon of pop culture, from T-shirts and inflatable dolls to Macaulay Culkin impersonating the painting in Home Alone. It's even found its way onto The Simpsons and versions of the picture with a shrieking Homer Simpson. Godfrey Barker, an expert on the art market, says all those knockoffs have actually made the painting a lot more valuable.
Fame unquestionably drives up prices. That's assisted by Homer Simpson.
The Scream could even break $106.5 million, a record for a work of art at auction. But its monetary value may be less important than its enduring value as social commentary. Louisa Buck is a critic for the art newspaper.
We live in troubled times. We have the financial crisis, which shudders on. And I think Munch's Scream really expresses that.
Even then, it's hard to look at the Scream without hearing Homer.
No!
I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
In San Francisco, residents on Chenery Street are a bit puzzled. They've apparently started getting tickets for not turning the wheels on their cars toward the curb when they park, as is typically required on hills. The residents are puzzled because they don't think they live on a hill by San Francisco standards. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, the reason they're getting tickets is either a desperate search for cash by the city or possibly a rogue parking attendant.
A rogue parking attendant. And finally, for all of you brainwashed by television in the 70s, what's ooey gooey rich and chewy inside? If you said Fig Newtons, sorry, according to the New York Times, Nabisco's new ads are calling them just Newtons. First of all, you can get them with fruit other than figs. Plus, many folks are of the mistaken opinion that figs lack pizzazz. I find it a thing of beauty, especially with balsamic vinegar.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio, New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.